in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. All events are free at the Powell Street Festival. More info on the Powell Street Festival can be found at powellstreetfestival.com. And Owen, thank you, Owen, from the Powell Street Festival, has sent me a track here by Gremlin. It's a track called Jaded, and it's off his forthcoming album, Soon Away, that's coming out on Car Park Records. Now, Gremlin are coming to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, as part of the Powell Street Festival launch concert. And that is happening Friday, August 1st, that's next Friday, at the Electric Owl, 926 Main Street in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. It's an early show, 8 p.m., and come out and see Gremlin from California via Japan, and openers late spring from Vancouver. So this is the kickoff concert, the opening concert of the Powell Street Festival. It's happening next Friday night at the Electric Owl in Vancouver. And if you want more information on that, it's powellstreetfestival.com to find out more information about that. And again, it's Gremlin from California and late spring at Electric Owl next Friday, August 1st, for the opening of the Powell Street Festival special early show. Also wanted to mention tonight there's a special benefit show going on at the SBC on Hastings Street, 109 East Hastings, the Smiling Buddha Cafe featuring the PAC AD. And it's in support of the Downtown Eastside Women's Center and the Downtown Eastside Skateboard Society. So that's tonight at the Smiling Buddha Cafe, the legendary Smiling Buddha Cafe. It's at 8 p.m. and it features the PAC AD. And also wanted to mention, I played him earlier on the Nardwuar Human Serviette Radio Show, Clarence Reed, a.k.a. Blowfly, is coming to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada with two live crew, and Blowfly are playing on August the 16th at the Fox Cinema in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. So right now, thanks again, Owen. Here's Gremlin from California with their brand new track, Jaded, with his brand new track, Jaded. And check him out next Friday night at the Electric Owl early show, 8 p.m. Here's Gremlin with Jaded on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show.
Inside. The Jalagas issue of Discorder is here. Be sure to pick up a copy around town or check it out online at discorder.ca and catch features on Pat Locke, Dirty Spells, Horses Records, The Beelines, and so much more. Also be sure to peep the Discorder playlist, now available through SoundCloud. And a very special thank you to this issue's advertisers, Audiopile Records, CCEC Credit Union, Catalano Street Party, LiveVan.com, the Ponderosa Festival, the Queer Arts Festival, the Rickshaw Theater, Rifflandia, the Media Club, Vancouver Fetish Weekend, Vancouver Fringe Festival, Vancouver Queer Film Festival, the Victory Square Block Party, and Vinyl Records.
LiveVan.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. LiveVan.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit LiveMusicVancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. LiveVan.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
CITR presents the return of early aughts power poppers, the Mark Kleiner Power Trio, featuring members of the New Pornographers, Flash Bastard, and Jungle, plus Zed Dreplin, East Vancouver's premier Dred Zeppelin tribute act. Friday, August 15th at the Fox Cabaret. Early show starting at 7:30 p.m. sharp.
It's not the way she called my name when she called me on the phone.
Advance tickets at Red Cat and Zulu. All proceeds go to Syrian refugee support.
The UBC Ski and Snowboard Club is a non-profit, democratic, student-run organization dedicated to promoting the sports of skiing and snowboarding and the associated lifestyle.
We endeavor to make skiing and snowboarding accessible and fun by actively seeking out the best deals and discounts for our members, as well as organizing trips to local ski areas and setting up numerous social events.
Come on one of our legendary trips and explore the glory of riding in British Columbia. Or join us at the bar to discover the true meaning of debauchery. Ask your roommate, ask your parents, ask the RCMP. Who has the most fun at UBC? You'll get the same answer. The Ski and Snowboard Club.
Duh. Joining the Ski and Board Club is easy. Come by our office, sub 115, anytime with some money to become a member. Your membership gives you access to all the deals offered by our sponsors, cheap beverages at our parties, an invitation to all club events, and of course, only members can come on the trips. Yeah.
come from animals. So we consume things like dairy, poultry, pork, eggs, beef, which have very great environmental costs. When Professor Milo made a comparison between plants and animals, the comparisons were even more stark. Raising cattle requires 160 times more land than planting vegetables, 8 times more irrigation water, emits 11 times more greenhouse gas emissions, and requires 19 times the fertilizer. So the conclusion of the study is raising plants and eating vegetables requires fewer resources than cows. So we can now become aware of our eating habits and how this can affect the planet. In our second animal story, you Ren and Stimpy lovers will love this story. We all know Stimpy, the stupid cat who loves his gritty kitty litter. Well, that gritty kitty litter and what is in it can now help save lives. That's right. Microscopic organisms are in your cat's doo-doo, and scientists are now using that to possibly treat cancer in the future. When scientists examined Stimpy's doo-doo, they found a bacteria called Toxoplasma gandhi, which is a single-celled parasite, which lives in cats' intestines. And it is found that this Toxoplasma gandhi can infect people and animals. So the infections are common amongst people, but our immune system attacks the Toxoplasma gandhi, which I will now call TG, and prevents infection. So researchers are harnessing the immune system response triggered by TG and is now directing it to fight and attack tumors. This field of study is called cancer immunotherapy. The professor doing the study is Dr. David J. Bizik. He's a professor of microbiology and immunology at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Dr. Bizik is using genetically modified Toxoplasma gandhi, or TG, parasite in a Melleror form to treat mice with skin and ovarian cancer. The research has found that the genetically modified TG shrinks tumors and increases the mouse's chance for survival. So this bacteria infects all animals, and because of this, doctors are now using the studies to invent ways to rapidly kill the replicating cells of the TG. Stay tuned. This will be in the future. Now, another story about animals. I don't know how this is relevant, except for I just love elephants. So recent research has found that elephants can outsniff rats and dogs. So elephants, believe it or not, have the largest number of genes that code for their smell sense. So the study found that elephants are superior sniffers. In a study in African elephants, researchers found that the elephant can smell the difference between men of different tribes. In Kenya, for example, the Maasai tribe, the young men, to enter manhood, they must spear an elephant, whereas the Kamba tribe, who are farmers, don't spear elephants. So the elephants, with their distinguished sense of smell, can stay away from the Maasais. Elephants use their smell to forage for food and locate water, and also for mating. Elephants can locate water up to a distance of 20 kilometers away. Female elephants can only reproduce a few times each year, so this makes the male elephant's sense of smell very important to know when a female can reproduce. The elephant smell genes, they have five times more powerful than humans and 5 times more than humans as well. Elephants have 1,948 receptor genes in their trunk, as opposed to humans who have 396, and orangutans have 296 receptor genes. So, believe it or not, this study is a great step towards the identification of genes related to olfaction stemming from the increased number of sequenced mammalian genes. Now, aren't we happy that we know that? And so says Dr. Sergio Orestes, who conducted the study. So what we know from this study is elephants really do follow their noses. Now, in space news, we're going to follow a story of Canada's contribution to space. Canada is contributing to NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission. I'm not sure what that OSIRS stands for, but it's a big word. It's a big moniker. NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center released a press release the other day talking about Canada Space Agency and its contribution, which is it's a significant one to the OSIRIS or OSIRIS-REx spacecraft. Canada is building the laser altimeter in the spacecraft, and it is a sophisticated laser-based image mapping system. This will create unprecedented 3D maps of asteroid Bennu. The laser provides valuable contribution to the mission, and so says Dr. Mike Donnelly, the project manager at OSIRIS. Canada will receive 4% of the asteroid sample from Bennu when the spaceship docks there in 2018. So that sample will be returned to Earth in 2023. OSIRIS-REx is NASA's third mission in NASA's New Frontier program, which seeks to explore our galaxy. In other space news, NASA's Fermi telescope finds a transformer pulsar. A transformer pulsar is part of a binary star system. A binary star system is two stars. One of the stars is a brown dwarf. The other is a neutron star. The pulsar is pulsar J1023, and the pulsars is turning on and off, something that is very strange. Pulsars are neutron stars, which rotate at a constant period. Some of them rotate up to 1,000 times a second. In the 60s, astronomers believed these little pulses from space, they dubbed them LGM, which stood for Little Green Men. They thought aliens were trying to communicate with us. But what it was the steady rotation of the pulsar. How this system works with a transformer pulsar is in the binary star system, the brown dwarf, sometimes its winds are deflected by the pulsar, but other times the streams surge through, form an accretion disk, and seem to turn off the pulsar. But this is due to the gas from the brown dwarf. So this obscures the signal. So scientists are now discovering more about pulsars. In military news, we all like to know about those little gadgets that the military brings us. In the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, which had a conference this last week, they announced five new military gadgets which could be transported for human use. One is dissolving electronics. So these are called Vanishing Programmable Resources, VAPR. They can disintegrate upon command. It's hard to say how those could be used in the civilian life. The second one is night vision cell phones. So we can now see with low-cost cell phones heat-sensitive things like people walking around at night. The third thing is called a teensy-weensy drone, and we love these cute little teensy-weensy cute things that the military gives us. The tiny drone provides aerial views at safe distances, and they could be no bigger than a battery. The fourth is location tracking boots, which we really don't need to get into. And the fifth is tiny atomic clocks. They are tiny, low-power frequency timekeeping units for ultra-high-frequency communication and signal jamming. I'm not sure how we can use that in civilian life. But anyway, they are 100 times smaller than the clocks now and 50 times less power-hungry. So they might have some kind of civilian use. This is Marco. You have been listening to the Science on
CITR. Thank you, Marco. We're ready to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM. Okay.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen, and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
We now have... Is it on? Yeah, okay. We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend brought to you by Environment Canada.
Tonight, it is going to be clear with the low of 13. On Saturday, it is mainly sunny, high 22, except 25 inland. The UV index is 7 or high. Saturday night is clear and a low of 14, and Sunday is sunny, high of 23, except 26 inland.
And that's this weekend's weather forecast brought to you by the Vancouver Weather Bulletin, courtesy of Environment Canada.
Up next, we have a report by Rohit Joseph discussing the ongoing military actions of Israeli forces in Gaza.
After 10 days of aerial and naval bombardment failed to stop persistent Palestinian rocket attacks, the Israeli government launched its ground invasion of the Gaza region last Thursday, July 17th. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has said today that he had not yet reached a deal between Israel and Hamas to call a seven-day humanitarian truce in the Gaza war, but is continuing to work on the project. Kerry's comments at a Friday evening press conference in Cairo closed days of shuttling between the Egyptian capital, Jerusalem, and the West Bank, trying to work out a week-long pause in fighting that has killed more than 820 Palestinians and 38 people in Israel. Speaking alongside the UN Secretary General and the Egyptian Foreign Minister, Kerry insisted that there was a general agreement on the concept of a truce, but that both sides had concerns over details of carrying it out. News 101 reached out to a student who was in Israel during the time of the conflict's escalation. He traveled with peers from one of his university's student societies. They had booked this trip originally in March, arrived in Israel on June 29th. They spent 2 days in Tel Aviv, 2 days in Eilat, and a week in Jerusalem. On the second day of their trip, political tensions started to rise after the bodies of three Israeli teenagers were found. We focused the interview on the differences between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and the lives of ordinary folks just trying to get by in Israel.
When you went to Jerusalem, what was the difference between that and Tel Aviv?
Well, first off, because Tel Aviv is a really Jewish city, where Jerusalem, of course, is a melting pot of so many different cultures and so many different beliefs, but of course mostly Jewish people and Palestinians. And at that point, the boys had been found, and another Palestinian boy was kidnapped, who was found a few days later, burned alive. So yeah, there was a lot of tension. You could sense it in the people. We were in an Arab neighborhood, and there are a lot of stories about the Israelis. When we talk to Israelis, there are a lot of stories about the Palestinians. And there were riots every evening. You could hear the air sirens every evening when the attacks from Gaza started. And so yeah, major difference from Tel Aviv.
Describe some of those situations. Whenever you did hear a siren, what was the routine? What was the drill? And what was it like being among people who were just trying to live their ordinary lives?
Yeah, it was amazing. On the news, we always saw people running across the streets when an air siren went off. But in Jerusalem, most people stayed calm. And actually, one of the first times it happened. The Palestinians started cheering, and in the neighborhood we were, they started cheering for the Arab Sirens, which was odd. But people stay very calm, and then normal life resumes. I think also because they live in the city center, and they're not that afraid of actual bombs dropping up there. Most have dropped in the outskirts of the city. So it helped in getting used to the rockets and the air sirens.
If you were speaking to the ordinary people, were people more guarded around you, or were they, if anything, expressing more of what they thought of the whole situation?
That depends on who you talk to, because the Palestinians, they have the emotional story in this conflict, so they're very open, and they want you to hear their story. They want you to know how terrible the living conditions have been, and they want you to share that with the world, where the Israelis have the more, I think, they rationalize the conflict more. And so they're more closed off in talking about it and how conditions are and what's happening in the country.
Was there any specific moment that you witnessed that shaped or changed your perceptions?
Yeah, to be fair, a bunch. We went into the West Bank a couple of times and spoke to people who have lived there for their entire lives. And yeah, those are very, very emotional, very impressive stories. But when talking about the conflict in Jerusalem and how it lived over there, there was an evening where we were very, very close to one of the riots. It was, I think, like 40 or 50 meters away from us. Mm-hmm. A couple of Jewish boys were taunting an Arab kid. And like I said, we were in the Arab neighborhood. So within seconds, the entire street helped this kid. Police came, tear gas was used, horses were used to knock the sites apart. And then the cafe we were at that point, one of the waiters got hit by a weapon. Smacked over his arm, had a big wound. Mm. And that was like 40 or 50 meters away from us. That was quite close. It was an interesting time to learn more about the conflict, but not the best time to feel safe or at home.
Thank you, Rohit. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Arts Festival, Regenerations, takes place in Vancouver from July 23rd to August 9th at the Roundhouse. This annual celebration brings together queer art from 27 nations, featuring 18 days of compelling exhibitions, transformative performances, and inspiring workshops. Experience the revolutionary power of art through cross-generational collaborations, artistic healing, and works of art from around the world. Tickets are now on sale at Little Sisters on Davie Street and online. Visit queerartsfestival.com. Regenerations. Dare to be challenged. Risk being changed.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have a report by Sahir Asaf on the downing of flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine last week.
Malaysian passenger plane with 295 people on board crashed in Ukraine near the Russian border on Thursday last week. The plane crashed over an area of eastern Ukraine under the authority of pro-Russian separatists and is thought to have been brought down by a surface-to-air missile. The rebels and the Ukrainian government have accused each other of being responsible for shooting down the plane. Concerns regarding the possibility that evidence may have been tampered with or hauled away by debris have been raised since pro-Russian separatist rebels took charge of the Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 crash site. There is a chance that the site may have been compromised. Such accusations were made by members of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe after visiting the site on Saturday, a day after they were asked to leave after being given restricted access to the farmland where the jet went down. Separatists have given international observers only limited access to the crash site. On Monday, U.S. President Barack Obama accused the separatists of hindering the investigation and removing evidence. Some experts say that remains are still lying in the vast crash site where recovery work has been impeded a week after the disaster. Dutch authorities have confirmed that only 200 corpses have been removed from the 298 people killed on board. Richard Marquis, a former FBI agent who led the task force investigating the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, said, quote, "I never say never about anything, but I kind of doubt they would identify and find all the pieces. I mean, if they sent a team of 1,000 people there, let's presuppose it was the Russians, they might be lucky and pick up every single piece and walk away with it. But I think in a huge crime scene, it's very difficult," unquote. At least 192 bodies are currently being held in a refrigerated train cars at a station 9 miles away in the rebel-held town of Torez. Reporter Nazin Moshri said, quote, "Officials are confirming things and denying things. If there are bodies there, it is a serious contravention of the site. It is tampering of a site which needs to be assessed by international monitors," unquote. Alexander Barade, Prime Minister of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic militia group, denied any evidence tampering, despite accounts that rebels have been snatching plane fragments. At the Amsterdam Schiphol Airport, travelers and visitors are mourning the death of almost 300 people who were killed in the tragedy. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott said that there was still a need for rigorous search of the debris zone and confirmed that police personnel had been sent to London and were ready to be deployed to Ukraine. He said, quote, "On the site, it is still clear that nothing is happening without the approval of the armed rebels who brought the plane down in the first place. There has still not been anything like a thorough professional search of the site where the plane went down, and there can't be while the site is controlled by armed men with vested interest in the outcome of the investigation," unquote. This begs the question, why aren't commercial airliners protected from missile attacks? Rand Corp, a defense think tank, conducted a study in 2005 and concluded that it would cost an estimated $11 billion to install laser jammers on all commercial airplanes in the U.S. and over $2 billion a year to maintain the systems. Alan Sens, a professor of international relations at the University of British Columbia, said that the best defense against such attacks is to avoid flying over conflict zones. He said, quote, "Don't fly over territories where there are ongoing hostilities, where you know people are using surface-to-air missiles," unquote. The tragedy of MH17 follows the mysterious disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, which went off the radar in March. Some people say they will now avoid flying with Malaysian Airlines, while others accuse the carrier of not learning from its past mistakes.
Thank you, Sahar, for that report.
Up next on News 101, we are pleased to present an episode of Wings entitled Seed Savers. This series is produced by Frida Werden, and this episode was produced and hosted by Indu Ramesh.
Today on Wings, radio producer Indu Ramesh and her team visit Vanas Tree, a women farmers' seed-saving collective based in the southwest Indian state of Karnataka.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Tana 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 tadina tandana tana dina tandana ta tandana na tana na tandana ta tandana na tana na bhumi taige bagge sharanendu bhumi taige bagge sharanendu bhumi ತಾಯಿಗೆ ಬಗ್ಗೆ ಶರಣೆಂದು ಭೂಮಿ ತಾಯಿಗೆ ಬಗ್ಗೆ ಶರಣೆಂದು
ಹಲೋ ಐ ಆಮ್ ಇಂದು ರಮೇಶ್ ಫ್ರಮ್ ಬ್ಯಾಂಗಲೋರ್ ಇಂಡಿಯಾ ವೆಲ್ಕಮ್ ಟು ದ ಶೋ ಅಬೌಟ್ ವಿಮೆನ್ ವಿಮೆನ್ ಹೂ ಆರ್ ಎಕ್ಸ್ಟ್ರಾಆರ್ಡಿನರಿ ವಿಮೆನ್ ಹೂ ಆರ್ ಇನ್ನೋವೇಟಿವ್ ವಿಮೆನ್ ಹೂ ಆರ್ ಆಬ್ಸಲ್ಯೂಟ್ ಟ್ರೆಂಡ್ ಸೆಟರ್ಸ್
ಎಂಥ ರೂಪ ನೋಡು ಬೀಜದ ಸೊಬಗ ತುಂಬಿ ಸುಸ್ತಾವ ಮನಿ ಮನಿಯೊಳಗ ತುಂಬಿ ಸುಸ್ತಾವ ಮನೆ ಮನೆಯೊಳಗ ಹಿಗ್ಗಿನ ಹೋರಾಟವನ ಸ್ತ್ರೀಯ ಕಾಲ ಹಿಗ್ಗಿನ ಹೋರಾಟವನ ಸ್ತ್ರೀಯ ಕಾಲ ಮಲ್ಲಾಡ್ ಮೇಳವ ಮಾಡಿ ಹೊಡೆದರು ಡೋಲ ಮಲ್ಲಾಡ್ ಮೇಳವ ಮಾಡಿ ಹೊಡೆದರು ಡೋಲ ಭೂಮಿ ತಾಯಿಗೆ ಬಗ್ಗಿ ಶರಣೆಂದು ಭೂಮಿ ತಾಯಿಗೆ ಬಗ್ಗಿ ಶರಣೆಂದು ಭೂಮಿ ತಾಯಿಗೆ ಬಗ್ಗಿ ಶರಣೆಂದು ಭೂಮಿ ತಾಯಿಗೆ ಬಗ್ಗಿ ಶರಣೆಂದು.
The song you just heard began with a worshipful obeisance to the Mother Earth. The song explained how the organization Vanastri is involved in collecting and preserving seeds. The singer herself, a member of Vanastri, composed the song. Vana in Sanskrit is forest, Stri is a woman. The name is appropriate for we are talking about an organization set up by women from little villages or farms in the forest. These women are farmers, vegetable growers, housewives who believe that nature provides us with ample sustenance and we should learn to respect the nature and the natural. The song also tells us about Malnad Mela fair organized by Vanastri. I'll get my young friend Smita Ramanathan to describe the atmosphere at the Mela.
It was a small fair, very businesslike, with women at the various stalls selling everything from seeds and tubers to ready-made garments. The very urban crowd at the fair seemed to be keen on getting everything from forest honey to huge tubers. There was a smell of something delicious being cooked at one of the stalls, and a queue had already formed at another to get a special kind of tea with herbs. The fair, minus the merry-go-round and the shooting gallery, was busy. We went round and found out more about Vanastri, the organizer of the fair. Vanastri is based in Shirsi, a small town in the heart of the Western Ghats, at a height of 1,940 feet, that is, some 600 odd meters above the Arabian Sea. The town is about 50 kilometers from the coast. Spread over an area of just 4.37 square miles, Shirsi has a population of a little over 100,000. The climate is influenced by the monsoon. It receives one of the heaviest rainfalls in the world. There are waterfalls, wild animals, and tropical vegetation around, even in this day of deforestation.
So, if everything is so good, why do women have to take up the kind of work they are doing, from horticulture to beekeeping to seed collection to making preserves, making ready-made garments, to make old clothes into quilts called kaudis?
Indu, what are kaudis?
I must explain that to you, Smita. Kaudi is a bedspread or a tablecloth made out of old clothes and patchwork covering the entire cloth. Looking at it, I remembered how thrift has been a quality among women, especially Indian women. Nothing is thrown away, everything is reused and recycled. Sunita Rao, the founder, walked us through the life of Vanastri. She told us about herself. Listening to her, even a radio person like me and my friends were just left wondering where she gets the kind of energy that is needed for this work.
I'm an ecologist by training, but I realized early on that my pure scientific training was not going to bring me any meaning or going to do society any good for the kind of person I was. So for the last 24 years, I've actually been working on a lot of applied environmental issues, mainly conservation education and women and their role in small-scale food production systems.
Sunita, in this age of overuse of chemical fertilizers
and the GM foods making news for all the wrong reasons. How do you even think of going back to organic food or collection and sharing of seeds? Do you think this is going to make an impression on the society?
Where we live in the Western Ghats of India, considered to be one of the 8 hottest biodiversity spots in the world, is where you have old agrarian communities practicing agroforestry and horticulture and have been doing it for centuries. The group I work with are traditional seed savers. It's nothing new. It's just that they had not come together as a group and realized the value of their seed saving. That there's been a lot of erosion in other communities where people have forgotten to save seeds, have lost the old varieties, and are dependent on company-produced hybrid seeds and the Green Revolution way of farming and gardening, which means a very high input of chemical fertilizers and synthetic pesticides. So all we are doing is organizing people into collectives, endorsing the women's, you know, the worth of women's knowledge and the expertise they have, and bringing it to other groups of people, both rural and urban, men, women, youth, and children.
Sunita, how do you start collecting the seeds? Does it mean that every farmer, every horticulturist brings the seeds and you keep a bank? Or how does it really work?
The way we have been working is every household has this tradition of seed saving whenever they grow a crop. And in our case, we largely work with small-scale food production systems, home gardens, and we call them forest home gardens because we live in the middle of forests. So forests are a very intrinsic part of this home garden system. So any crop that is grown, the best fruits are kept aside to be used as seed producers. The best one is kept aside for the seeds it contains. And these are saved, they're dried or often preserved in the gourd or the lady's finger itself, and then sown again. Seeds have also been exchanged and gifted traditionally, and this is how seed saving happens in a very simple level in households. The way we have been working, the way we've organized the women is, we've realized that there is a landscape level community seed bank. With this kind of effort, cumulatively, what it amounts to is a landscape level seed bank, which is not a cryogenic facility, which is what a conventional high-tech seed bank is about. But it is, you know, a seed bank across the ecoregion where every household is participating in keeping the seed bank alive.
Sunita, I don't want to go into the politics of the agriculture practice in India, but still, can this kind of a thing feed the billion-odd people of this country?
This is a question that we get asked very often. Not just get asked, it's just flung at us. We are challenged and often also told that this is not going to work. We are a very small outfit, but it is our belief that we are providing living solutions and working answers to many of the problems that beset our society, including malnourishment, adequate production of food, and the powerful role that women are playing unrecognized. Women have become invisibilized in our agricultural scene. And only when all of these come together will really the answers become convincing. And the answers are not through words, but really through all the work and action that's happening, that in a sense a radio program like this will serve to highlight. When you say fertilizers have been, you know, are as old as the history of agriculture, because you need to maintain the health of the soil, and traditionally soil has been considered to be a living entity. And also people have been formulating plant growth boosters. But the use of synthetic fertilizers really started around, the Second World War, when chemicals left over from the production of ammunition were used to produce nitrogen-based fertilizers. So in India, for the last 50 years, we have been using these fertilizers. And along with those, the pesticides have also come in. So it's really pretty recent. And with the coming of the Green Revolution, there has been a tremendous increase in the use of synthetic pesticides and fertilizers. The incidence of cancer, I've been reading, and you know, there's been empirical data to prove that it's increasing tremendously.
That's our program for today, July 25th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Alex Sarah Davis.
And I'm Morme Zanke. Today's show was produced by Seher Asaf. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.